This week, the PBS series Independent Lens features a documentary called Race to Execution. The film focuses on the role of racial discrimination in the application of the death penalty. As part of the project, the National Black Programming Consortium held a podcast competition. They invited college students to submit their takes on this issue, which is how they met a 28-year-old Morehouse College student with a unique perspective. Sharif Cousin was 16 years old when he was arrested and charged with the murder of 25-year-old Michael Girardi in New Orleans. As he explained on his podcast, Sharif had what seemed like an airtight alibi.
You know, I was in jail for maybe 3 months before I found out that I was at a basketball game at the time of the murder. I didn't know I was at a basketball game the night the murder happened. I just knew I didn't do it.
Nevertheless, a jury convicted him of murder and sentenced him to death. In 1996, Sharif Cousin became the youngest person on death row. 2.5 years later, his conviction was overturned. He'll tell you how that happened. Former death row inmate Sharif Cousin joins us now from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and it's good of you to be with us today.
It's good to be here.
I mentioned you seem to have an airtight alibi. It evaporated in court. How did that happen?
Well, first, what we have to think about is where this murder occurred. This murder occurred in the French Quarters of New Orleans. And when we think about the French Quarters, you know, we think about tourism.
Mm-hmm.
We think about, you know, this is how New Orleans make their money, you know, Bourbon Street, Mardi Gras. And if a crime happens in this part of the town, someone has to go down for this crime, and someone has to go down fast for this crime. And since the hurricane, you know, New Orleans has been, you know, in the forefront with the politics, you know, with the dirty, corrupt police, with the, you know, with the DAs, the prosecutors, with the politicians, you know, everybody's beginning to know about these situations. And with my case, you know, I was at a basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're 16 years old, you're playing basketball. If you're 25, you know, if you're in a game and a murder occurred, you know, it's not like, oh, I remember where I was 3 days ago at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, you're not going to remember that. It's not like we walk throughout the days, every day, writing down everything we do. And, you know, I found out I was at a basketball game. We had a videotape of the basketball game.
With a timestamp on it. So people knew when it happened.
Right. And I had teammates that could have come to trial to testify that, hey, Sharif was in his game. And I had three other teammates that could have testified with my coach that said that, hey, Sharif was in a car when the coach dropped me off first. Sharif was in a car when the coach dropped me off and the kid was second.
Mm-hmm.
Sharif was in a car and I got dropped off before Sharif. He was the last one in the car with the coach. And so to an average layperson, who can get arrested for a crime with this type of evidence?
Mm. We're speaking with Sharif Cousin, who was sentenced to death at the age of 16 for a crime he didn't commit. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So when the evidence was doctored, when your witnesses were disappeared across the street and weren't there to testify, and when you were then convicted, what did you feel like?
At that time, I was 16 at that time. And when that happened, when I was in court and the jury came back and said, guilty. And the few days later, when the jury came back and said, we were sending this man to die for this crime. At that time, I thought about how could this happen? I thought about why me? You know, I thought about, you know, sometimes we hit a term, I've seen my life flash before my eyes. You know, people kind of said it out of context. But I actually saw my life flash before my eyes. And, you know, at that time, I really didn't know anything about the system. I didn't know how the system works. You know, I didn't know an appeal process. You know, I thought that once a person is sentenced to death, they die tomorrow, the next day, or the next week.
Hmm.
You know, so at that time, you know, I began to think about me dying.
And you were then sent to one of the most notorious prisons in the country, to Angola.
Yeah, I was sent to Angola at 16. At that time, I was the youngest person on death row at that time in America, and I was sent to Angola.
And when you learn more, talking with the other men who were there, nevertheless, that's got to be a dreadful place.
Yeah, it's a dreadful place, and being 16 and being 17 and actually witnessing execution, you know, with a guy you've talked to, you know, every day for months. And, you know, one day, you know, tomorrow, he's like, you know, I die tomorrow. You know, I just want to leave you with a few words. You know, I'm talking about a healthy man. You know, that was a reality check. And because I know my situation, when I, you know, with the evidence that I didn't do this crime, you know, then it's hard to even judge another person on death row or in prison, period, because you don't know the circumstances of their situation.
Yeah. I've read that when you were told the news that, in fact, your conviction was overturned and you weren't going to be executed, that you felt you needed to be restrained in your joy. You had to be feeling joy, but you couldn't shout out and jump up for joy because why?
Because there was another guy on death row who lived maybe three cells away from me, and he received word the same day that his case was not overturned. His case was actually upheld. And because I didn't want to, you know, jump up and down for joy, knowing that another guy who I've been talking to for years, you know, cannot feel the same joy. You know, so out of respect, I just, you know, I remained calm. But inside, I was so jubilant and inside, but I remained calm on the outside.
Your ordeal was not over. You had pled guilty in the course of this to some robbery charges, and you still had some time to serve on that. But eventually, you were released. Through all of this, were you angry? You must have been furious.
At first, I was real furious. I was hurt, for one, because, like I said, I was 16. My family didn't know anything about the system. And when I was arrested for that murder, there was one guy called in to the radio, to the news station, and said, "I remember this guy. This guy robbed me." And at that time, I had gold teeth in my mouth. But when this guy had gotten robbed, I didn't have gold teeth in my mouth at the time he had gotten robbed. But the judge told my lawyer that, hey, if he doesn't plead guilty, you know, I'm going to take him to trial. And if a jury comes back with a guilty verdict, I'm going to give him 50 years in prison. And so coming from death row, still having to do more time, you know, for charges that I could have fought, you know, that was a big, you know, emotional unbalance a little bit. But
we just have a few seconds left. You're now a student, a college student. Have you come to terms with what happened to you? You're looking forward to your future?
Oh, yeah, I'm a college student at Morehouse, and, you know, I have plans on going on and becoming an attorney where I can actually go back and help some of the guys that I've left behind. And I'm also a community organizer. And one thing that I've been working on really hard lately, I work for an organization called Fairness for Prisoners Families. Well, I help family members who have loved ones incarcerated. We organize them, and we begin to challenge the system. But there's, we know we've heard the Million Man March. We've heard the Million Woman March. We've heard about the March on Washington on 63. You know, actually, for the United States Social Forum coming to Atlanta this summer, we're looking for 20,000 to 30,000 people to come together. But we're also looking at having a family reunion of ex-felons and family members. This is going to be the first time this ever happened in this country. So I'm looking forward to that.
Sharif Cousin, thank you very much. As we mentioned, his podcast is part of a competition funded by the National Black Consortium, where college students can submit their take on the death penalty. You can download Sharif Cousin's podcast at their website. There's a link on our website, npr.org/talk.